One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories. We're the show that uses the way songs become intimately bound to our memories as a means of getting to know our guests. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. Our guest this week is Mark Danny. Mark is the founding producing artistic director of Theater Zone, a professional equity theater company in Naples, Florida, and he created and runs the theater program at the Community School of Naples. Over his career, he's been involved with many Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional productions as a director, music director, conductor, and drummer percussionist, including New York City directing credits for What Would Esther Williams Do in a Situation Like This, Sea Fever, and Aggravation. He has conducted national tours of Les Miserables and Barnum, and as a drummer percussionist, Mark's Broadway credits include Chicago, Annie Get Your Gun, Les Mis, Miss Saigon, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and Grand Hotel. He's also been a part of national tours of The Phantom of the Opera, Fame, Hair, 42nd Street, Nonsense, and the European tour of Evita, and he's a member of the Society for Directors and Choreographers and the American Federation of Musicians. Hey there, Mark.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, this is my pleasure.
Were you listening to music on your way here?
I was.
What were you listening to?
I actually was listening to a Mozart piano concerto on Symphony Hall.
Okay. Is that typical for your listening habits?
Depending how long the car ride is, it will go between 70s on 7, Symphony Hall, or Howard Stern.
Okay.
Yeah.
That paints a pretty good picture.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is most directly in your wheelhouse? Directing, music directing, conducting, which I guess those are kind of similar, or percussion drums?
What I mainly do for a living right now is stage directing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Over the course of your career, which has been the one you've spent the most time doing?
That would now be also stage directing. The first half was music, drummer, percussionist, up into conducting and music directing, and then moved into directing.
Understood.
Which,
so that is the arc of things.
Correct.
If you had to guess, how many shows have you been a part of in your life?
Oh, God. Probably within the 200-plus range.
Could you remember them all if you were in some way triggered back to a memory? Could each one have distinct memories?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
There must be a rich tapestry of memories in there, because I know, you know, each show is its own thing and the relationships that get built and the memories. I mean, what's that like to have all that in there?
It's fantastic. It's a great way for me to know where I was in history, because I was on a tour doing The Phantom of the Opera. So I can always remember, oh no, that was in 1996, because in 1996 I was in Louisville when that happened. And so everybody thinks I have a great memory, but it's only because I have specific shows that I was doing in certain cities at times when events happened in my
it's
life.
It's like a life map in
your
head. That's pretty cool.
It is.
Okay, so where did you grow up, and how would you describe the musical background of your childhood when you grew up?
I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and while I was the oldest of four, I was in a neighborhood of kids who were 5 to 7 years older than me. So they were my older siblings, and the classic rock of the 70s sort of defined me. That music was playing in garages across the street, out of windows, and these neighbors who were older than me would lend me these records that were just fascinating. My earliest memory is, so remember, here's early 70s. There's no seatbelts in cars. It's the station wagon.
I was there. I'm a few years behind you, but not many. I did the math.
And I'm sitting in the middle. If there's two adults, you're sitting in the middle of the front seat, you know, and the buttons on the AM radio that you pushed and it moved that little red thing around, uh-huh. That was what I got to play with, and I just lived for that. And my earliest memory is Joy to the World. To me, it was called Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog, Three Dog Night. And the other one was Admiral Halsey and Uncle Albert, Paul McCartney. I called it Hands Across the Water. And those two songs, I lived for finding those on the radio. And I was, 5 years old.
So it was in the car that you remember hearing those for the first
time. Oh, yeah, that AM radio. And then I got a Christmas gift of a charcoal piece size of a transistor radio that was hung off my bike handle, went to bed with me.
Also AM?
Yeah, back then that was AM, early 70s, till I got a stereo later on that I had the FM radio going.
What were your parents listening to?
Johnny Cash and, Lawrence Welk and, it was nothing that I had a lot of turn that crap down in my house, so yeah.
Were you the oldest of the siblings?
Yeah, yes, I'm the oldest.
Did you influence them musically?
Interestingly, not really. There's age differences between us, 3 years before the next one, 5, and then down to 9 years, so there's different generations of stuff they were listening to at the time.
Hmm. When was you... you're a drummer. When did you first start banging on things as if they were drums?
Probably on the dashboard of the car.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the elementary school band director comes to your classroom and introduces all the instruments for the potential taking up in the band, I wanted to do drums because I was rock and roll infatuated. They did not offer guitar or bass, so drums was the obvious thing. So I started doing that in the ninth grade.
Were you playing any other instruments just, as a hobby, or was it just always drumming?
Always drumming, although when I was, I think, at the same time, my friend and I made a pretend electric guitar out of, his dad was a carpenter, we made a guitar out of it, and my life was sort of changed in 1975 when the Bay City Rollers had this TV special.
Okay.
And there was these guys with these girls screaming at them. And it wasn't that I was like, oh, my God, I want girls. It was like, look at the effect these guys are having. And they had those Scottish pants, the big bell bottoms and the tartan. And there was this blonde drummer, Derek Longmer was his name, playing drums. And I was like, oh, God, I want to do that. This is it.
When you played drums in high school as a ninth grader, were you playing like, was it marching band drums? Do you have a drum kit? Was there a jazz band? Like, what was that?
No, when you start, it was like triangle.
Yeah.
And then somebody got to play the snare drum. That was the best guy got to play the snare drum. And if you were lucky, when we got to middle school and if you could handle some form of drum set, maybe they did a number that had a drum set in it, and then you were really cool.
Did you ever have a band in high school? Did you ever have a band maybe after high school?
In college,
like a rock band?
Yeah, in college we did. I went to a conservatory, and we had a pickup group of musicians that were just amazing, and we would just pick up, and we had only 5 songs in our repertoire, but if we got pulled into a club, we'd start playing the 5 songs. We'd start taking requests, and the guy who played piano, he knew every song, could sing at perfect pitch. Somebody'd shout out a song, he'd say, yeah, he'd turn and say, it's an F sharp, it's funky 4, here we go. And we'd play whatever anybody asked for. So.
Were you immediately able to keep rhythm? Did you have to work your way into drumming, or did it just come natural?
I was probably one of the world's worst drummers until I got into high school. That's when I really took it seriously. I guess before that I could play the drums, but I didn't focus on being able to read and the real logistics of rudiments and stuff like that. I could sit down by the drum set and play along to the Doobie Brothers or something. But really my life changed and focused in that this is what I wanted to do for a living in high school.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that after your first song.
We'll move into the
I'm taking this seriously
phase. Yes, yes.
Last question. If you could learn an instrument instantly, Matrix style, which would you want to learn?
Oh, piano.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to take piano lessons. I couldn't because I was taking percussion lessons trying to prepare for college and money was a factor. I painted my drum teacher's house to trade for lessons so I could prepare for my college auditions. But I wish I could sit down at a piano. Those people are just so lucky to have that skill and that ability.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. It is time for your first song, the Rolling Stones song.
Yes.
What's the story?
Well, I love the Rolling Stones. And moving into the FM radio days in the later 70s when I'm in middle school, there was a radio station that we all seemed to listen to in middle school, the whole group of us. And they would do requests and they would do things and you could do shout outs to each other. And they would do album giveaways. And I heard on the radio Miss You from the Some Girls album. And it blew me away. And I wanted that album and I was trying to save up money for it. And that night they were giving away the album Some Girls. And the 12th caller, you know, and I'm like, oh, I'm calling in, and I won. I got on, and they record you, and it's like, and this is Mark from Williamsville, yeah, and whatever.
What a different time it was, but I remember.
And I was like, oh, my God, I won this album that I wanted so badly. And then, you know, the next day at school, everybody's like, oh, because they all heard, you
know,
because we're all listening.
Yeah, because it was what you listened to.
Yeah, and, you know, the Stones – in 1978, when I was 12, were on that tour, and they came to where the Buffalo Bills play. It was called Rich Stadium at the time, on the 4th of July. And I'm 12 years old, and I'm like, I'm going to that concert. And, of course, my parents are like, there is no way in hell you're going to that concert. And in hindsight, they're probably right. A Stones concert in 78 was
not the
best
place.
Oh,
yeah, I was going to say exactly that.
Yeah, I did get to see them in that stadium. Back in 2015, I was in Buffalo and they were coming through and I got tickets to finally see the Stones. I had never seen them until then. So, but uniquely also about this song is the disco era was hitting at that time. And mm-hmm. I was a very avid, you know, crack the disco albums. But Charlie Watts lays out, there's a disco beat under this rock song. It's called Four on the Floor.
When I was looking up to get it for the show, there's also an extended disco version of it. And it doesn't sound that much different. Because once I listened to that and then went back and listened to this, I couldn't unhear the disco-ness of it. You know what I mean?
Again, the genius of them for creating a rock song that still had what was happening at the time and probably played in clubs even back then. So,
could your 12-year-old self have imagined that 32 years later they'd still be playing in that same
No.
stadium?
And I don't think Mick Jagger thought that either. Yeah.
Well, shall we listen to it?
Yeah.
Okay, this is Mark Danny's first song here on Three Song Stories. This is Miss You by the Rolling Stones from their 1978 album Some Girls. So how did you physically get the record? Was it a record that they let you
Did
you have to go, you know, your mom have to go pick it up?
We had to go pick it up at a store. I can't remember what store it was, but when you got it, then they put you on to somebody who said, okay, and on Thursday it will be at, you know, Sears Roebuck in the mall. Go up and give them your name, and then they gave you – it came with Al Stewart's Time Passages. You won both of them. So I won that album too. So
Did you wear it out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, Beast of Burden's on that, Shattered. I mean, just great songs on that album.
You said that your folks were listening to Lawrence Welk. Was your mom cool with you going to pick up a Stones album at Sears?
Oh, no. They didn't have a problem with me listening to this stuff. They just didn't want it too loud.
Understood.
I wore a lot of headphones.
So what else were you listening to at that time?
Oh, and in middle school and stuff. Well, the other band that changed my life going into middle school was Kiss.
Oh.
Now that I think forward to what I'm doing today, you know, the theatrics of what they did, that was unheard of at the time. I'm like, this is really wild what's happening. I was allowed to go to my first concert when I was 11. I saw Kiss, but I had to go with two neighbors who were 18 at the time, who my mother convinced to take me.
That must have been a wild ride going with your 18-year-old teenage neighbors.
Yeah, it was. But to see them, you know, these days you can go and see anybody you want. Back then, you had pictures to see these guys moving.
In
how
person,
they,
yeah.
Yeah, it, and how the stage was set up with the that was just blew me away. But, yeah.
So in high school, you started taking drumming seriously, and then I have now inferred that you went on and pursued it in college at conservatory. Paint that arc.
Well, there's some very, very important people in my life, and I was very lucky that when I went to high school, the man who was the band director at this high school was very young. He had just gotten out of his master's degree and was one of the wonderful, most great conductors I had ever seen. He went on to a really successful career. But his first job was my high school. I should point out that in Western New York, the high school music programs were killer good. I didn't realize that until I left, but killer. And so not only within your own band program, but all the other high schools, there was just killer musicians. So to get into these all-county bands and stuff, which was great because it held you at such a standard.
Yeah.
And we all liked each other. So there was all these other drummers who went to other schools and stuff, and they were kicking my ass. But I looked up – I'm like, God, how'd you do that? You know, and then we'd work with each other. So these music programs, I just got immersed in it and was so inspired by this band director. And I started taking it really seriously. Like this, even at my younger age, you know, music was all I ever thought about. I knew I'd have to do something with music, but now I was like, I have to go into this. There's nothing else in my life that means as much to me as this. So I got really serious about learning percussion well, and I got very serious on wanting to be a conductor as well. I got immersed into the jazz classical scene. So my whole high school, college career was the 80s. The pop music scene at that time wasn't really what I was immersed in. I'm really immersed in. And if people who know music, the early 80s, there was this fusion jazz movement that came out that was really cool stuff, you know, Return to Forever and Al Di Meola and all that stuff. And we got immersed in that. And a group of friends, all of us were these top-level musicians who were going to actually pursue it. And we would go drive around. And we were very close to the Eastman School of Music. That was an hour away. We'd haul up there and hear that jazz band. They'd have Wynton Marsalis soloing with them. So we were really influenced by this. And our band program was really a kicking butt. So for a while, I was really immersed in the drums. But and I should have a little footnote here because it's going to lead into my future. Because I became a proficient drummer and could read music, I got known by the music directors in Buffalo as this kid who could read music, and I started getting hired to play theater shows all around town. And I'm moving up to pretty high-level ones. Like, there were union musicians around
me. So you
were
playing with grown-ups. This wasn't like youth theater productions, and you were one of the kids. You were like a kid amongst professionals.
Yeah, I played my high school musical my freshman year. I wasn't very good, and I sat back and played like the triangle behind this really great senior. But my sophomore year, we did Grease, which is a great drum set part. And I played it, and I sort of killed it. And this music director who was brought into my high school to music direct it started saying, hey, can I hire you to do these? And then other people found out. And so I got to stop mowing lawns, and I got gigs. And I even got I had to lie at the time. I was only 16, but I had to say I was 18, which was the drinking age back then.
You had to get into some of the places that served alcohol
or whatever. There was a nightclub in downtown Buffalo called Ruben's Backstage, and on Fridays and Saturdays they did three sets from 9 to 2 called Bravo Broadway. And they would change it up, and I was just in there immersed. I was playing 3 hours every night. I was making money. It was fantastic.
Any of your friends have similar gigs, or were they all jealous of you?
I would help get some of my friends some gigs if they needed like a sax player or a clarinet player and stuff like that. But the good thing is that every show needed a drummer, you know. So and I was my family life changed a little bit. My parents had split when I went into high school. They weren't really keeping an eye on me that much anymore, which was sort of
a good— growing up fast.
Yeah. And so I think I got away with going downtown and hitching rides and being out where other people's parents might not have allowed that. But it was very much a learning experience.
Huh. Yeah. So then you went to college, or you said conservatory?
Yes.
For conducting, right?
The reason I went to the college that I picked specifically was to work with the man who was the conductor there at that university. Yeah.
So what was that time like?
Can I take a time out?
Yeah.
We've glossed over the second song, If I Get to College.
Okay.
Does that matter to you? The Land of Make-Believe was what we did at the end of the high school.
We might just leave all this actually in.
So I'm happy to keep going that way, and we can go back to why I picked the second song, but it's
well,
up
no.
to you.
Well, no. If your second song has to do with your college time, then why don't you know—
My high school time.
I mean your high school time.
Yeah.
Oh, your second song has to do with your high school time.
Yeah.
I don't even know what we're going to do with all this, but we probably just get rid of it. So
the college time, it all leads one to the other. It's totally up to you. But that was a direct relation to when I picked the three songs, I was trying to think of these moments in my life of things that were sort of pinnacles. So,
well, let's go ahead and do your second song.
Yeah. So you want me to set that up?
Yeah, absolutely.
So my last year in high school, it was our last year, seniors, and we we were Mangione fans. Mangione's pretty amazing because he had the respect of true jazz people, but he also crossed over into the commercial world and was still respected, you know, Feel So Good and all that.
I know that one.
Yes. And so we would see him, and he's a Rochester guy. He went to Eastman, so he'd always be playing around in the Buffalo area, and we'd go see him. And he had an arrangement that was on an album I had of The Land of Make-Believe, that he had a full orchestra behind his Mangione band and he had a singer. And I just thought, this is so cool. Look at what it immersed my two things at the time, classical music and jazz music. He orchestrated for a symphony, had his band, he had a singer. And so we got together and went to my band director, who coincidentally, that was his last year also before he moved on to a college job and then on to huge, great things. And we said, hey, the last concert, you know, can we do this make-believe arrangement? You know, we got Karen over here. She can sing and I can play the drums and we can get our choir director was a really great jazz and pianist. We'll get Mr. Levy to play piano. And I don't know if he did it or found it, whatever. He found the arrangement for band, for high school, for a band, plus a little jazz band and this. And so our final concert, you know, we got to do this arrangement of Land of Make-Believe with the singer and the band behind us. And it was just sort of a special moment of sort of culminating what we had been through in high school together.
Can you remember the first day that you sat down with them and said, let's do this, and started hearing it being made by you?
Well, I remember the pitch. And then I remember when we moved onto the stage from the band room the week of the concert, and we brought in the Mr. Levy to play the piano, and Mr. Maguda, who was the band director down the street, who also was a flugel player, and then the band and I moved the drum set onto the stage, and we brought in my classmate Karen to sing. And I remember just doing that for the first time, and I was like, "Yeah, this is awesome."
Chuck Mangione is a trumpet player, right?
Flugelhorn mostly.
Flugelhorn. Yeah. What is flugelhorn? You mentioned that. That's why I wanted to clarify because I didn't know this.
If you look at it, it's a larger trumpet and it's in a different key and it's sort of a mellower, softer sound.
It explains his sound.
Yes. Yeah, so his sound is very uniquely the flugelhorn.
So who was the student who got to be the Chuck Mangione?
Oh, this was Mr. Maguda, band director from the other – who is good friends with my band director – who said, hey, can you come over and do the flugel part on this? Because also, well, we had good trumpet players, but we needed them in the band part. So,
right.
Yeah, so it was sort of a big love fest, you know.
Well, let's listen to it. This is Land of Make-Believe. It's the title track off Chuck Mangione's 1973 album of the same name. It's Mark Danny's second song here on Three Song Stories. And that's downright theatrical.
Yeah, I know.
Are his songs like that? I mean, I have to be honest. I really only know Feel So Good.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like in his wheelhouse? I mean, that I could hear that. He's like, you could base a whole Broadway show off of that or something.
Yeah. Honestly, the first version I think of it is has no singer. It's him playing all that on the flugel.
I see.
And then this album I picked up when I was in high school had this – it was a best of something and had this track. And I was like, what is this? It's a full orchestra with this vocals. I don't know where the lyrics came from, but I just thought it was great. But no, I don't know – I don't know that he has singing on any of his other stuff.
Okay, good. That wasn't just – okay. Yeah. And you played it where and for whom?
It was our final band concert of my senior year.
So in the auditorium
of the high school. And, you know, at sort of towards the end of the concert, this was like this special sort of pops type of song, and we brought in some special guests. And
how was it received?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, it's such a great song, you know, and it's so fun. And you know, you hear the orchestration at the end that Mangione did. It's it's a wonderful showcase for the band. You know?
I want to know who wrote those lyrics because there was some interesting stuff going on.
Oh yeah.
In there.
I wonder who sang it.
It was a high school student that sang it, or was it?
Yeah, we had a girl who had a very similar voice to this sort of that lighter jazzy poppy sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And she wasn't in the band. She was a pianist. Her sister was a flutist in the band. She had graduated already. And, you know, it was all me. Oh, we'll get Karen to sing, and we'll get this, and we'll do that.
You were conducting. You were directing.
I was, putting the pieces in place so the band director
would be
like,
you were producing.
Yeah, all right, we can do this, yeah.
Okay, so that was the final performance of your senior year. Now let's get on to college.
Yeah, so college, I specifically went to Baldwin-Wallace University in Cleveland, and which people don't realize is very close to Buffalo. It's a three-hour drive only to there. Very similar city. Back then, college kids were mostly regional. You know, there wasn't the cross-pollination to these other parts of the country. So there was a huge draw from Western New York to Baldwin-Wallace University. As I said, those high schools were killer musicians there.
Right.
They did a lot of recruiting from Western New York.
Huh.
One of the reasons I picked Baldwin-Wallace was the man who was the conductor of the orchestras and stuff there, I really wanted to work with ever after having such an amazing experience with my high school band director. I wanted to pursue conducting seriously. And besides him doing the stuff at the college, he also was the conductor of the Cleveland Ballet. And so when I was in college there, I immersed myself in with him. My major instrument was drums and percussion. I got a degree in music education because that course load was the closest to conducting. You had to learn how to play every instrument. You had to do orchestrations. You had to do theory. You had to do all the stuff that you would need to be a conductor. And then he had a conducting seminar that you could take. And he and I became very close, and I started going to ballet rehearsals with him. He would invite me to go and watch how things were working. And I really enjoyed being in a pit. Conducting from a pit, because not only when you're conducting an orchestra, you're conducting an orchestra. When you're in a pit, you're conducting an orchestra, but you've got to follow and be with whatever's happening on a stage.
Yeah,
if it's dancers, you know, he used to drill on us, if you don't have your tempo right, somebody will be hurt. You know, people's careers are at lives. You better know that tempo. And then the man at the college who did the vocal stuff but also did the operas and the musicals started talking to me about assisting him. And so then I got a little immersed in the opera world. As luck would have it, I met the woman who I'm now married to for the past 25 years in college, and she was a musical theater major. And I could speak her language.
Yeah.
I was doing all these – I knew all these shows. I loved these shows. I had seen them, and I could speak her language. And in the process of sort of – dating her and getting to know her, this sort of light bulb went off in my head. I was like, God, musical theater's in English. You know, these operas are killing, and I know them, and I love being in a pit. I should focus on that. I think that would be cool. I'm going to focus on that. I know this world. And as luck would have it
– Plus, you'd be closer to her.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as luck would have it, there was a guy who graduated from Baldwin-Wallace in the 50s. His name was Jack Lee, and he went on to be a very famous Broadway conductor. He was the original conductor of Sweet Charity with Gwen Verdon and Peter Pan with Sandy Duncan. And he had just finished doing My One and Only with Tommy Tune. And he came back to my college to work with singers, sort of share with singers his knowledge, you know, returning back to his school. And they actually did it, taped it for a local PBS show they did from Broadway to Berea. Berea was the suburb of Cleveland. And my wife got cast in this. And she was nice enough to tell him that her boyfriend wanted to be a Broadway conductor. And he was nice enough to say, well, I'd love to meet him. And he sat down with me and said, what do you want to do? What's your background? Got to know me. And he said, when you graduate, you guys give me a call when you move to New York. And so we did, and we moved to New York.
Were you planning on moving to New York before he said that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, because once
that was the focus.
Once my path was that, if you're going to do that, Broadway's in New York, right?
Yeah.
So my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, we packed up and we just headed to New York, and
this would have been like what?
Early 1988.
88.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I got a job. I blanketed a commutable New York distance schools that were to find a band director job.
Oh, because you had a music education
degree. I did.
Yeah.
And so I found a middle school in Long Island that hired me to be their band director. So I went and put myself in Long Island for 3 years and was a middle school band director to pay bills. And my wife went right into Manhattan and was a bartender at Fridays and allowing her to audition during the days and stuff. And Jack Lee, the conductor, said, I do this workshop. He did a very popular workshop with Broadway performers on how you get from a scene into a song seamlessly. In the musical theater world, you should – so the person – you shouldn't be like, oh, now a song's starting. You should be talking. You should be talking and then you're singing. And if you do it well, the audience is like, oh, when did they start singing, right? And so he would do this. They were very in demand. A lot of celebrities would take it. And he told Karen and I – Karen's my wife – I'm doing this. He said, Karen, you should take this. And he goes, Mark, you should be my assistant. Which meant I sat next to him on the piano and I turned pages.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also gained the most incredible knowledge of directing, not only music directing, but of directing. He was working on characters and stuff, and it was unbelievable. And in this period of doing this workshop, he turned to me one day and he said, Mark, you – the Broadway world's really focused on the conductors being the pianist. They're in the rehearsal room playing the piano and they move up to the podium and he goes – you know, you're not a really good pianist. I'm actually a terrible pianist, but he was being nice. But he goes, I would get into the pits. Get into the pits as a drummer, percussionist, and move up from there. And he said, Tommy Tune just called me, and he's asked me to music direct his next Broadway show. It's called Grand Hotel. And now I'm only 22 at the time. He said, you're too young for me to offer you a position, but I'm going to insist the percussionist use you as her sub. Subs the equivalent of the understudy.
You're the understudy.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. So every Broadway, you know, there's 8 shows a week. Every one of those musicians in the pit have a approved sub list so they can be sick. They can go to their kid's baseball game.
Yeah.
They can do whatever. And so this was a treat. So I got to be a sub for this next show, Grand Hotel. And it was sort of magical because – it's your first Broadway show. We weren't in a pit. The Broadway set for Grand Hotel was where the mezzanine balcony was a second floor of the hotel, and the orchestra was up there.
Oh, wow.
And you wouldn't know this unless you were up there. When you stand up there, it's not a solid floor. It's a, it's like a steel mesh, so you could see through. You could see the actors.
Right. That probably helped.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it was cool. And the other thing was these huge chandeliers used to fly in through the orchestra, and there was these two big holes and come down below us because they were – remember, we're the ceiling of the hotel. So it was sort of – and, you know, the audience is right there, and so you're part of it. You know, we had all be dressed in these tuxes and look like this big proper 1928.
You're one of the actors in
yeah,
a sense.
We're part of the scenery and this huh. tuxed, you know, 1928 lavish hotel set. And there was the show – opened in October and started picking up some momentum as it got to the Tony time. And there was an actor, an amazing actor, who played this role of Kringleline. And this, the character is dying. The character worked his whole life in Germany pre-World War I and slaved away as an accountant, as a bookkeeper of this rich CEO of this company. And he finds out he's dying of cancer. And so he takes all his money and I'm going to live my final days as royalty in the Grand Hotel. Huh. So the whole time this character you see, his costumed in clothes that are too big. It really looks like he's dwindling away. They did an amazing job. The actor's name was Michael Jeter. And he played this character who he did such an amazing job. Like I said, for the first 75% of the show, you're seeing this man who's very weak. And there's a song. So I'm leading into the next song here. There's
okay,
a song
yeah, yeah,
at
yeah.
this moment.
Go with it.
I'm realizing we're setting that up. There's a song, and he befriends this baron who's a shyster. And but he befriends this guy who somehow connives and manipulates and is able to stay in this hotel with him. And he gets him a stock tip. And he takes all his money and play, and he comes back and he cashes in. And he has this moment in this bar that night at the hotel where he goes, no, I won. And he throws this money around and he says, well, we have to take a glass and drink together. And it's one of these very happy celebratory moments. You see this poor man's life is happy and they're dancing and they're dancing. And there was the bar was symbolized by a pole that was held across the stage. And they're all dancing around the bar, and he's very Dick Van Dyke like. He was rubbery. And at a moment, so remember, the audience has only ever seen this man who seems very weak. All of a sudden, he gets carried away, and he starts flipping his legs, and he starts, in almost like a marionette puppet, and he starts kicking his legs in the air, and he starts jumping around, and the audience went bananas. And by the end of it, he lands, and he just collapses because the man's sick, you know, into the Baron's hands. It's sort of sad. This is 1990 now, 89, 90. Michael Jeter passed away. He had great success after this. He got immediately cast on a TV show called Evening Shade with Burt Reynolds at the time. Mm-hmm. He made the movie The Fisher King. He was on to a great career.
Oh, I remember The Fisher King.
Yeah, he passed away of AIDS. Hmm. Sadly, The Baron, same thing. So the two original cast members didn't live on much past that. So, but it was a magical time in my life, playing the show every night on a Broadway stage at the age of 22. You know, the whole reason you had moved to New York, and Jack was a huge help for me in my career. And then, I went on beyond that into the conducting world and the directing world. But this
it must
was
have
my
just
first.
Been like this. You know, every night when you would walk off, leave the theater and walk out into the streets of New York, you must have just been like, "Is this really happening?"
Yeah. Walking into the theater every night and going, I really tried to – every time then I sub six Broadway shows. Every time I would go into a pit, I always told myself, just – you got to suck this in. Like look up at the chandeliers. You're in a Broadway pit right now. You know, savor this moment.
And you didn't have a phone to distract you.
No, I did not.
Well, let's listen to this song through that lens. This is – so what I have is the performance from the Tonys in 1990, which I guess would have – it's, Michael Jeter and Brent Barrett.
Yes, Brent Barrett had replaced David Carroll, who was sick at the time, unfortunately.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Well, this is We'll Take a Glass Together from Grand Hotel, the musical. Like I said, Michael Jeter and Brent Barrett performed at the 44th Tony Awards in 1990. It's Mark Danny's final song on Three Song Stories. Were you watching that performance on TV back then?
Yes, I was. I did. I watched it that night.
What was that like?
Well, it was magical to watch it. You were hoping, that the show would win. It didn't win Best Musical that year. It won Best Direction and Choreography for Tommy Tune. It was nominated for 11 Tony Awards that way. And the show did run for a good 3 years. So, yeah.
When was the last time you were in a pit?
Broadway pit?
Yeah, Broadway pit.
When did I move to Florida? 2002. I was still subbing when I left New York. The shows that were open at the time was Chicago and Les Miserables. We're still open in 2002 when I – so those are the two last shows I was in a Broadway pit for before I moved down here to Florida.
Before we get to moving down here to Florida, let's talk about your conducting time.
Oh, yeah.
You conducted national tours of Les Mis and Barnum.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about just conducting in those maybe.
Yeah. Barnum was my first tour, and I was actually a drummer on that, and we put it up in Chicago. And the pianist was a local music director who had no intention of going on this tour. This was a one-nighter, bus and truck. This was 1991. This is the next year. It was my first tour. It was a great thing to only do when you're young. And and he could not get a pianist to go out on the road with it, to come in and to learn the show. I had a friend in New York who I said would do this, but I told the music director, I said, listen, I'm a trained conductor. I'm playing drums. I'm waving sticks around. I said, let me just do it from the drum set. It was only four pieces, a very small pit. And so they agreed to it. They built a podium that I could fit the whole drum contraption on, and I was in the center. And then my friend who we brought in the pianist, he just had to worry about playing the piano part, and there's a keyboard, and there was a reed player, and we were – so I conducted from the drum set. It was a great learning experience. Again, every night you're in a different theater, so it's like, where are we today? Where are we today? Then I moved on to some bigger tours, 42nd Street, 25th anniversary tour of Hair, which was a real thrill to do, and Phantom of the Opera. And then I was on the tour of Les Miserables. And the music supervisor I became friendly with, and I explained my whole background in training and conducting. And they started using me for a rehearsal conductor. I would conduct the rehearsals for the understudies and stuff. And luck would have it that there was some transitioning going on. And the next thing you know, they said, we're moving you up. We're flying in a drummer from New York. You're conducting. And so I conducted Les Mis for a while on the road, which is – that's an amazing show. It's through sung. It is a – challenge. And like, there's no stopping while there's dialogue to look ahead to see what's coming next. It's just
a train going down the tracks.
It starts and it doesn't stop, so you better know what you're doing. And the tempos are changing, and it was a thrill every night to do that.
So when did you do your first directing?
Well, so interestingly, while I was doing the rehearsal conducting of Les Mis, there was a woman who's a fabulous director. She's very successful now. And they put her in charge of maintaining sort of the quality of Les Mis. And she would be out there working with the understudies, and I would be the conductor in the pit during this time. And we would have dinner, you know, after the rehearsal before a show and stuff. And I would discuss things and talk. And she said to me, she goes, have you ever thought about directing? And I said, well, she goes, oh, I think you have an eye for it. You know, we talk about things. You have a total understanding. I really think you'd be very good at it. And at the time, my wife had started having a really good career as a choreographer. So she's traveling the country and the world as a choreographer when she wasn't performing as a performer. And I told her, I said, I think if I ever have a chance, I might like to try directing. And when I finally left the road, I did one more tour after Les Mis. I did 8 tours. I went on to the National Tour of Fame. And with the whole reason was to get home. I had been on the road a lot, and I was hoping that would come into Broadway, and it didn't. It's also how I happened to find Naples, because we were playing Artist Naples.
Oh.
This is 1999, and my wife and I decided to buy a vacation
Naples
home.
Philharmonic.
Yes, back then it was a Philharmonic, and we bought a vacation home there, and while we were playing down here. So when I left the road, I went again, and I blanketed high schools who might be looking for a director, because I wanted to try to do this. And I found one in Long Island. Oh. And it went very well. And I very quickly, through my connections that I had, people started saying, oh, Mark's directing now. And I got to do some equity workshops with some high-profile people. And then I got asked to direct something here and there. And so it moved fairly quickly. And then we were down here, went over to – my wife got pregnant with our first son. And we came down to this vacation home, and we went down to the community theater, the Naples Players. They were hiring directors and choreographers. And we said, we have a vacation home here. I direct. She choreographs. You know, we have a house. You just have to fly us here. And they hired us. And community theater, of course, is what people do for the love of it, not for a job. So their rehearsal period's quite long. So we were down here for 7 weeks. And in that time period, somebody was working on the show from the Community School of Naples, who decided that I needed to create a theater program for the Community School of Naples, in which I very quickly said, I am not moving here, so leave me alone. You know, and he kept very persistent. You know, we really should, come look at the school. Come. And we went over and looked at the school. My son was like 6 weeks old. He was in a stroller at the time. And I should point out that we agreed to come down to direct and choreograph. I almost didn't, because I was doing so much work in New York City. And this was August of 01 that we were offered this. And my wife had said, she goes, it was very insightful. We're going to have an infant, and we have a washer and dryer in the house in Naples, So yeah. So we agreed to do it. And then, 9/11 hit. And my son was actually born 2 weeks to the day after 9/11 in Manhattan. I had a 9-month pregnant wife.
Made Naples a little more appealing.
Yeah, well, and it was a good move that I didn't realize. And so we came down here. What the selling point was is when I went to the head of the school at the time, and this is in 2002, and I said, if I create this theater program for your high school, would you let me start a regional professional Actors Equity Theater Company that could be in residence at this little theater you have on your campus? And after we discussed how that might work, we came to an agreement. And it allowed me to move here and work with high school kids, which I really like doing. I like working with students. I work with FGCU students also. I've been very close with their theater department there. They're wonderful. But I also kept my professional side. I've been able to have a professional company where I'm bringing in Broadway veterans and celebrities and able to do high quality work at the same time. So, you know, that's why I'm sitting here in South Florida.
What? How long? When did Theater Zone become a thing?
We incorporated in 2005, and we did our first full production in March of 06. We're going into our 18th season.
And your new season is already arranged and in your
the
promotional materials are all out there and everything?
Yeah, on the website, everything. Yeah, we announce in March every year. And so we're ready to – got through, you know, some very tough times for the live performing arts.
Yeah.
But we're still here, so.
How far out do you work? Are you booking two seasons from now too?
Yeah.
Or at least laying groundwork?
Yeah. So in the summer, because we're so seasonal here, we don't really do stuff in the summers. We're really prepping because it's full steam ahead when we start this year. But come January, I better know what I want and have the licenses procured so that the marketing department can be ready for us to announce in March. So come the fall, once I get done with all this prep work now, I start, but I have a short list that I'm always reworking around, and then you get, you know, you think you got a great list together, and you apply to the rights, and they're like, no, you can't have that one. That's going on a tour. All right, now I got to find another show. You know,
I totally get that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about concerts, rock concerts. Oh. What's your peak concert in your life?
Well, you know, seeing the Stones finally, you know, was I think I cried. Kiss is always magical, so that's my first concert, and because they're so theatrical. Again, as an 11-year-old, you only see pictures. So to finally see those guys live and to see, you know, the tongue going and the fire and the pyro and the blood and whatever. I will tell you that I saw them in 96 when they got back together, put the makeup on in Madison Square Garden. And then I saw them again over in Sunrise back in 09. And then right in 2019, we went up to Tampa and saw the farewell tour. I took my son, one son, and we sat close, and it was just – I don't know. It's just a killer. You know, those shows, they're great shows.
Are they your favorite band, or are they your favorite band to see in concert?
It's so hard to answer these. I have so much – you know, I appreciate so much music in different genres. Yeah, I guess they were great to see in concert. But it's so fascinating. You hear the Eagles, Don Henley, I think, told the story about, you know, they called that the Hell Freezes Over tour because when the Eagles broke up, they said, well, this is it. We'll never get back together. And then all of a sudden these classic rock stations came out and they started playing the Eagles. They started playing the stuff that I was listening to, my neighbor's garages. And so all of a sudden I'm reliving my childhood by not having to go beg for money to buy a concert ticket. So I'm going and seeing these people. I just saw McCartney in Orlando, you know, unbelievable. So and I'm bringing my sons. It's such a different world from where you're not going to a Stones concert to where you're bringing your whole family.
How old are your sons?
I have one who is 20 and one who's 19.
Do they have musical tastes that align with yours? Have they brought home anything that made you raise your eyebrows?
The 19-year-old has totally inherited my taste in the classic rock world. And no, they have not. Sometimes the one son, the younger son, is the one immersed in music. He plays guitar. And he'll bring in somebody. I'm like, I never heard of them.
I was going to say, so they've brought you music.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you and your wife's musical tastes align?
No.
How do they diverge most?
Well, so remember, she's a dancer, choreographer, singer. She was a big disco nut, you know. So I like, you know.
Did you disco?
No, I hate dancing just to begin with. But I listened to the stations that used to, you know,
make fun of disco.
Yeah, they'd run the needle across the record and smash it and what have you. So, you know, she's like, oh, you know, this was the roller rink at 12 years old. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, yeah.
Have you ever seen a big act or musician in a small venue?
Yes. When I was on the Fame Tour, we were in Indianapolis and the road manager came down to myself and the bass player and said, hey, you guys Rundgren fans? And we're like, yeah. And he goes, playing at a club down the road. He goes, I got a rental car after we load in. You want to go? And I walked into this bar and there was Rundgren, you know, sitting as close to me as you are.
Wow.
And his drummer was Prairie Prince, who, if you know the name, was the drummer for the Tubes.
Wow.
So I know. So that was sort of cool. You know, he was right there. And, you know, you can catch acts up at the Barber Man, and you can be right on top of those people. That's if you, you know, if you're up in the balcony, it seems far away, but you go down in the orchestra, it's pretty intimate. It's
I took my daughter there for her first concert when Jason Isbell came to town a few years ago, and I got seats in the front row. So we were like, you know, 15 feet away or something.
Yeah,
no, that's pretty cool. When you go, I'm assuming you at least sometimes go to musicals.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like as a consumer of musicals.
Constantly, yes.
Do you have trouble turning off your work brain? Are you like, you know, looking at how they're doing the cues and whether they're getting, you know, or can you just be there?
No, that's all I look at. but I don't know that I call it trouble. So it's so funny. One of my music directors asked me that and he said, well, I can turn it off. And I'm like, but it doesn't bother me.
Right.
I don't sit there and go, I wish I could just
enjoy. You don't
feel
distracted.
No.
You're getting more out of it in some ways.
Exactly.
Because of that.
Uh-huh. And then because our stage is smaller than Broadway, I sit there counting how many people they have and how do they do this and he's doubling his part. No, it's always on, constantly on, and I'm constantly deciphering if this is – now, sometimes there'll be a show I just know I'm not going to be able to do. So then I just go – but I'm still – you're always looking at how they do that lighting cue. And I'm always looking up at the ceiling and looking behind to see where the – yeah, you're keeping up on what the industry's doing.
I have a very light version of that because I run the Fort Myers Film Festival. So I'm up in the booth. I'm turning on the mics and the lights and the playing the films and playing the music during the breaks. And so when I went and saw Les Mis at Barbara B, I was just like, how are they doing? Like, I couldn't stop looking at, like, I'm imagining the entire machine and the effort and the people and the time that have all gone into making that just seem flawless.
Yeah.
And I just was so taken by that.
It is. And the touring's amazing. When you do the touring, you know, Phantom had 24 trucks. Les Mis had 17. And they figure out, you know, what's the first truck that has to go in and the first truck that has to go out and what comes down first that go. I mean, that's a whole management that I can't imagine.
Do you have a favorite movie musical?
I think Jesus Christ Superstar was one of those shows when I was a kid that I loved, and I used to have that record. And it also was a little bit of Forbidden Fruit. I had a very Catholic dad who was convinced, probably because some –
that was fairly Forbidden Fruit.
Okay, so there you go.
You said a little forbidden. I'm like, I think that might be more than a little.
I think somebody, some higher up in the Catholic Church said this is not good, and so I was forbidden to see it. So if I had to sneak around to, you know, listen to that soundtrack and watch it. But I love that. I also think the modern day, when they do a musical modern day now, they do really good. I thought Chicago, they did an amazing job with how they portrayed that show.
Did you ever get to be in a part of a performance of Jesus Christ Superstar?
No.
No?
My dream drum show, and I've never played it. I've never directed it. I've never done anything with it. I've seen it so many times. I love it. It's sort of sad.
You were talking about like the Buffalo theater school scene was so robust. When I was in high school, I was friends with a bunch of kids that went to Cypress. I went to Fort Myers.
Yeah.
And that was right when their theater program started just really taking off. Mm-hmm. And one of my best friends was Jesus and another, you know, and they were all in it. And it was like, it was the best high school theater anybody'd ever said. They had to keep it over for like 2 weeks. They packed the house.
Yeah.
And I was so proud. I didn't know anything about theater. I was like a golfer and a baseball player. But Jeremy was up there doing this thing that made everybody just lose it. And it was so cool.
Well, I will say that reminds me that in high school, that band director who I told you about, apparently when he was in college, when Superstar was big, he wrote a jazz like 25-minute piece that was like a suite, I guess you'd call it. And he pulled it. We convinced him to pull it out, and we got to play it. And it was – that was – so that's my closest
that's
to being
the closest
able to play
you got.
Superstar on drums, yeah.
Okay. You ready for a speed round?
Oh, God. I'm not good at the speed. Okay.
Well, do your best.
I'll do my best.
Do you have a nickname that has stuck over the course of your life that you would share with our listeners?
I don't.
Not at all?
No.
Okay.
Mark, you know, it's one syllable. It's quick, easy.
Do you do karaoke?
No.
Have you ever?
No.
Why?
I don't like karaoke. I don't like people trying to – it's either people who are trying to sing or even worse, people who just think they're such great singers and go up there and, you know –
Very
think,
little in the middle.
Yeah.
So are you a singer?
I wouldn't call myself a singer. I mean, I certainly can sing. I wouldn't call myself a singer. I wouldn't do it. But I sing. I sing when I music direct. I could do it, but there's people who do it so much better.
If you were a championship wrestler, what music would you enter the arena on?
Oh, interesting, because my oldest son is a huge wrestling fan.
Oh, so you have a little context.
Yes. The problem is some of them already have it. I would use the Rocky theme.
Okay.
Yes.
What would your wrestler name be?
Oh, good one. See, I start thinking.
that's what it's for.
I know. How about, you know, everything I think of has already been used. How about the Music Master?
The Music Master.
We'll do that.
If you had to guess, what song have you listened to the most times in your life?
Oh. For pleasure or for work?
You know, either way.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that so much. For pleasure or for work. I've never heard that before.
Well, there's some you have to listen to because you're working on it. It's an opera or something you're directing. So you're listening to it over and over to try to think about what you're going to do with it. God, I go in such – oh, Jesus. These are hard. This is hard, Mike. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. You don't have to.
Okay.
There's no mandatory answer on speed round.
Pass.
If you were a cocktail or drink of some kind that was distilled essence of Mark Danny, what would it be?
Well, it's got to just be what my favorite drink is. It's just a vodka martini.
You have to personalize it somehow so we can add it to our cocktail cookbook.
Good Lord. Mike. These are profound.
We are not your mother's radio show.
I have to maybe we call it the music teeny. Is that what you're asking, or what ingredients are in it?
Yeah, just you know, you can literally just you know put an umbrella in it and call it a music teeny, and then it makes it yours.
We'll put a stir stick with a treble clef on it. How's that?
There you go. That's right. Perfect.
Yeah.
Song you wish you could hear again for the very first time?
I think 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover.
Hmm. Do you have a memory associated with that?
The thing about 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover is that drum beat is crazy nuts. Not that he played it, that he thought of it. And that's my favorite drummer, by the way, by the name of Steve Gadd. That Paul Simon came and said, here's this little tune I have. Boom, the story is all inside my head. And he came up with. That's what blows drummers' minds.
I'll have to listen. Jared, pull up 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover.
Oh, yeah.
Because I kind of, this is one of those early songs when you said it, it kind of takes me back to the 70s and being a kid. Because it's one of those songs, it's a storyteller song.
Oh, I love this song.
You know, I want to hear it again for that. So
we
can focus on the drummer.
It blows drummers away that he thought of that.
Right, just conceptualizing it.
Then how he plays it is also a whole other.
Problem, I love it.
Yeah.
And I'll now, from every time I hear that song for the rest of my life, I'll think, I'll pay attention to the drums.
Quick thing, Steve Gadd, who was Mangione's drummer, and when they met at Eastman, when you ask him how did he come up with that, he took it off of Marching Band days.
Huh.
He took a Marching Band cadence and moved it around the drum set.
Wow.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Are there any songs you will avoid listening to because of the memory that they would revive?
Oh.
Which is kind of a cruel question.
It is. I can't think of that. I know there's songs I can't listen to that I love that were just overplayed and I can't stand them because they were overplayed.
Is there an example of one of those?
Yeah. Like, for instance, Billy Joe's Piano Man is an amazing song. And when I heard it, I would play it over and over. And then over the years, it got so overdone, I churned the channel. And I don't mean any criticism against that song. It's just I can't do it. And the other one in the Broadway world is Memory. You know, when Memory came out, it was very unique in its structure and chord. And then now I'm like, I cannot hear – I can never hear Memory again, please. I walk out of the bar.
I have a memory that just popped into my head of Piano Man in the 80s driving around with my friends playing it on a tape in the car.
Yeah.
And we kept rewinding over and over just so we could hear the Davy Navy part.
Yeah.
we were in a loop. We must have listened to Davy Navy.
I must have done the same thing because it was such a great song and it hit some point where you're like, oh, I can't listen to that anymore.
Absolutely. If you could broadcast a song into the head of every human simultaneously, which song would you give them?
Oh, my God. Mike, where do you come up with these? Oh, I would like something that makes people happy. And there's so much to pick from. I'm going to go to my Kiss guys. Let's just throw – I'm going to rock and roll all night and party every day.
No.
Just go in that.
I think that's a great choice.
Yeah.
Do you have any albums that you will always want to try to listen to in their entirety because you love them as a whole piece of work?
Oh, so many. I think Fleetwood Mac Rumors was an album I played through, and I could not get over how great that was from track to track. Yeah, I think it's great to hear that.
Do you have a fourth song that you almost chose, but you had to cut from the list because it could only be three? That if you, you know, if so, you know, is there a little short version of the story?
There's so many songs. You know, when I first started thinking about this. The ones I picked sort of took me on my journey, but there's so much music in my life. And now I'm trying to think what they were because I narrowed it down so much. I mean, the Les Miserables stuff is very – no, I'll go one step further. My first big national tour, big one that wasn't the Low Roads, was 42nd Street. And when I hear anything from 42nd Street – it brings back a very magical emotional response to me, which is nothing that your listeners are probably – it's that stuff from the 30s. But it's beautiful, fun music. You're Getting to Be a Habit with Me was the song I can always think about playing. But it was such a great time. I was in Boston with it, and every time – it just brings back memories.
What would your 14-year-old self think of who you are today?
Oh, you'd be shocked.
Shocked how?
Because 14-year-old self
– was just starting to take drums seriously.
Yeah, just learning to count. And certainly the theater world was not part of 14-year-old self because 14-year-old self in the spring got pulled into the orchestra pit of the High School Musical to play some percussion by his friend who was a senior drummer. And the magic of sitting in an orchestra pit hit him for the first time. So, yeah, this is – this. You know, 14-year-old self was a lost soul.
14-year-old self would be pretty happy then probably.
Yeah.
About the amount of more magic you've been able to get to.
Yeah.
Any advice you'd want to give that 14-year-old?
I think I did what my advice would be. Just follow your dream. You know, don't – do what you believe in. Yeah.
Okay, it's time for you to recommend three people that you'll share this with.
Well, I have – he doesn't know this yet, but I have a music director who comes down for two shows this year. His name is Keith Thompson, and I met him on the 25th anniversary tour of Hair, and he's an amazing musician and conductor. He's done huge national tours. He went out to Vegas where he was the music director of We Will Rock You, The Queen, The Producers, and – for 8 years, Jersey Boys.
Huh.
So when he's down here for his two shows, I'm going to convince him to come on this show.
Excellent.
Yes. And then, I don't know, we have a future. We haven't cast yet. We got a lot of actors when we cast our season, which is coming up in September. I think they would – I think I'd have to beat off how many people would like to – with a stick that they'd like to come down here and do this. This is fun.
Well, then share it with all of them and then let them fight over
who gets to come. Yes.
Okay. Well, Mark, you've done it. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, except this was so fun. This is so – I mean, I love talking music. This is so fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is our online content producer and host. Chris Duffus is our executive producer. And our theme song was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. If you'd like to hear a slightly shorter version of this conversation, but one that contains longer versions of the songs, go to WGCU.org and click the Listen tab on the top of the page. For this week's parting tune, we're going back to episode number 179, guest Melinda Isley, who operates M Creative PR, where she works on behalf of Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall, the American Cancer Society, Bennett's Fresh Roast, and Community Cooperative. Melinda's first song was You Don't Bring Me Flowers by Neil Diamond and Barbara Streisand. It's bound to her memories of when her parents were going through a rough divorce when she was about 7 years old.
The kids were in the very back seat, you know, the station wagon. So, of course, no seat belts or anything. And we were going to a movie. We'd probably driven through Wendy's or something on the way to get some food. And luckily it was dark. And this song came on the radio. And I just started bursting out into tears. I just started sobbing. And I'm trying to, like, hold it in. And I'm trying to, you know, and it's dark, luckily. And I'm trying to, like, not sob and pretend that I'm not crying. And but it's just because I listened to the words. And it just hit me that, you know, my parents were breaking up. And yeah, so it was, you know, it was in it. And again, I've every time I hear it, I mean, I've tried to listen to it so I don't cry anymore. But it's a beautiful song, don't get me wrong. But it just really, my parents were like this golden couple when they got married. And there was so much hope. And they were married for 25 years before they got divorced. Mm. So it had been a long time. And but it also tells me, you know, parents never know what kids go through in a divorce. And because they don't ask, but also kids never truly explain what their emotions are during a divorce. So, yeah, so this one still brings it up for me. And, you know, it's you grow older and you learn to forgive your parents, hopefully, and it's part of being mature that you learn. Relationships fall apart. But, yeah, so I don't know if this was the first time I heard the song. It was the first time I listened to the words. Mm. And then the words just really hit home with what was happening.
Keep listening.
Next time on Three Song Stories.
Oh no, I'm bleeding! Oh my god, I'm bleeding! I'm bleeding! Oh my god, I'm bleeding!